Welcome to Contemporary Communications Conference. My name is Jerry Fialka. The subject is the motives and consequences of the 60s counterculture. On the phone we have Bob Dobbs, who published the newsletter The Perfect Pitch and has authored the book Phatic Communion with Bob Dobbs. Also joining us is Paul Krasner, who is the publisher of The Realist and whose current book is entitled Confessions of a Raving, Unconfined Nut, Misadventures in the Counterculture. Robert Anton Wilson wrote in his book, Coincidence, quote, "Everybody in the counterculture owes a great debt to Paul Krasner." Paul, could you begin by discussing the motives of the counterculture?
Well, generally speaking, the motives were idealistic and communal and futuristic and philosophical. And putting the concept of freedom into action, you know, whether it was experimenting with drugs or dressing in gaudy fashions or trying to get through life without having a job, whatever it was essentially experimental.
And Bob, what do you think the motives of the counterculture were?
Well, I'll put it on the level of Aristotelian causality. Traditionally, Aristotle laid out four causes, which was used in traditional exegesis of the Book of Scripture and Book of Nature. So since a lot of the counterculture to people was a retrieval of the medieval environment, let me just tentatively lay out the four causes. The first cause is formal causality, which is the literal level in traditional exegesis. I would say the formal cause, which would be the motivating factor or the factor that would create the motive in people as responders, the formal cause would be the satellite environment, which would include television and radio, and the beginning of automation and computers. The material causality, which is the allegorical level, not the literal level, would be the need for television to have content and to have a dialectic in that content. The efficient causality, the third level, which is usually called the moral or tropological level, that would be people like Paul Krasner and Alan Dulles or whoever ran the MKUltra. It was human beings themselves would be the efficient causality. And the final causality, which is the eschatological level, would have been me. So those four causes are the levels I approach it at. The effects of that, of those four causes, are what we have today, which is Paul Krasner talking to me via Jerry Fialka's conference.
But did you put Alan Dulles and me in the same category?
Yes, within efficient causality as the dialectic. I think that that they were your opposition when you attempted to have freedom. I think that that dialectic, that opposition, is necessary to be content for television, which is the second level of causality, the material causality. And the real cause, the most comprehensive cause, was the fact that satellite went around the environment in 1957 with Sputnik, turning the planet into a theater, a global theater, which motivated all individuals in all cultures and all institutions themselves to become actors and to confront each other in a dramatic context. Now, I don't know, Paul, how familiar you are with my kind of talk, but that may be a little complex, but I'm just laying that complexity out, and then we can work through it through your responses.
Truth, I have not read your book, and you probably haven't read mine.
Oh, yeah, I've read your Ravings. I just read it.
But I've been reading through transcripts of some of your dialogues, and it does get a little bit abstract, but I'll hang in there.
Right. I mean, the abstraction is an attempt to put a perspective on things.
Well, you'll be interested in this perspective. During the last presidential campaign, Jerry Brown was speaking to a journalism class in the college, and none of them had ever heard of Marshall McLuhan.
That's right, and William Thompson told me he spoke, or he was a guest lecturer at the University of Hawaii in 1985, in the Department of Communications. In that department, none of the students of his course had ever heard of Marsha McLuhan.
And some of those same students think that Abby Hoffman is the congresswoman from upstate.
Okay. Now, you see how this is the second level. This is the content of TV.
And I've gotten a few of Paul Kantner's groupies.
Well, the content of television causes this Finnegan Wake kind of confusion, especially since we might live at least 100, 200 years every 12 months in the information overload that people experience, that confusion about the past would be natural for people born or young in this period. You know, that's why any movement's going to get filtered through the software environment, and its intentions, that movement's intentions, will never really last very long. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, because I've gotten that response to my book where people whose image of the 60s is a bunch of hippies sitting in a circle smoking pot and or a bunch of hippies civil and anti-war activists getting beat on the head with billy clubs by cops. And that was, in a sense, all they knew about the 60s.
Right, and when you read your own book, it's just the whole involvement with Mae Brussel, there was a real drama going on there. It was very serious. I mean, maybe John Lennon was in trouble from 72 on. Maybe people like Strom Thurmond didn't like him talking to you and Mae Brussel. The drama of that is totally forgotten about.
And that's the only part of John Lennon's files that the FBI won't release around that time in 72.
That's right. And it shows the drama by people. What you were doing against the Nixon White House was so small compared to the overall effect of the media swill that you and the White House were operating in. That's the main point that any future movements would have to contend or think about. Because none of the movements of the 60s have gone beyond being presented now in some kind of cartoon phase or cartoon style. But what's interesting is that I think every generation under this TV satellite environment, as long as we have it, will feel the need to act out what was acted out by the beatniks, the hippies, and the hippies. And I think that's what Terrence McKenna and the whole sense of revival of the counterculture happening now will happen in 10 years again, will happen now, because that's the effect on young people, on Americans, by that mixed corporate media TV satellite environment. It's inevitable to have that effect. You see what I'm saying? So it's recycled within the generations, but for whatever the media is talking about, which is based on polls and collective consensus, they will not deal with the retrieval and the replay by generations. I mean, what's talked about in the media now is Whitewater and whatever else, and Rush Limbaugh, and that is what will be defined. That will be the content definition.
But I think that the one of the differences is that with the as the movie would be titled Counterculture 2, with that bursting out as it is now, a lot of the people who are covering it in the media were part of Counterculture 1, so it might get a different treatment than it did in the 60s.
Yes, I mean, partly that the baby boomers are a bit surprised that it has been retrieved, and they're sort of fascinated by the retrieval.
Yeah, I think so, and many of them were, so they have less of an old guard stance than the reporters did in the 60s.
Right, and also the technological environment, I call it the electric autonomy, that the VCRs and personal computers, and that whole environment is more amenable for kids to have a sense of individuality and imagination today and to actually do it, at least on the software information level, compared to the mass media environment we had in the 60s. So it's a better environment for it. So I would say that's part of the retrieval factor, too. But I know that in the 70s and 80s, you met kids, they studied the 60s or they talked about it, they felt sympathetic to it, American kids, and yet the megalomania, or let's say the imposing image of Reaganism and Pope John Paul II and all that was going on in the early 80s, which felt like it was near on the edge of a nuclear war, the weight of that made kids respond in a certain way that they wouldn't be able to really act out on their desires and motives. But the environment today makes it better technologically. So it's thanks to the engineers that have created the revival of the counterculture on one level.
And Jerry was just telling me before about this, what's it called, 99, that video?
Tribulation 99.
Tribulation 99, which is in book form, but it's also in video form, which is going to reach a lot of people, young people who whose MTV attention span does not make them avid readers.
Yeah. I think that the, say, within 10 years, we might be able to predict, and Rush Limbaugh has been talking about this, that, say, the 12-year-olds, the 13-year-olds, who might react to the decentralized freedom that people have with media today and through the 90s for their own personal expression, we may have a kind of a very conservative or almost a Victorian sensibility come back with the younger generation just by nature of human stubbornness. They have to assert an identity against the prevalent one. So the counterculture may be retrieved for a while, but then it might flip into and become regarded as the establishment and rebelled against.
Well, what do you think of this? Just a couple of nights ago, there was a sitcom called Hearts of Fire, which had Rush Limbaugh as the guest, as a romantic figure, playing himself.
Yeah, I saw it.
And this program was produced by Linda Bloodworth Thomason, written by her, and her husband was a director.
Harry somebody.
Harry Thomason, and these are the people who are Clinton's best friends. Now, what significance do you think this has?
Well, that's on the level of the second causality, material causality, where the dialectic is symbiotic. It's a yin-yang situation. The Clinton myth needs the Rush Limbaugh mythic stage to counter, but television swallows both of them so they can be presented on television. Both polarities are in the medium that created Clinton, that's the Thomason gang, and are also creating something for Rush Limbaugh to argue against, because he's always talking about Slick Willie as a product of those two people. So there was the... And that's the allegorical level. That's the allegory of what I'm talking about, the dialectic that feeds on each other.
Well, then, if that dialectic is always necessary, then how will the drug wars evolve?
They won't stop.
Oh.
You know, it'll continue. See, that's the funny thing, is that why... Many people you hear on talk shows and that realize that the drug wars didn't accomplish their goal of the drug wars of the 80s. And many people of the 60s, 70s know it didn't do it then. So why does it have to keep going? Because when you have an electronic environment that threatens everybody's tribal and personal identity, then people feel a mandate to impose their group values on the rest of society. Now, television can get ratings on the battle between the dialectic of these group mandates. So that always will be necessary for content. So you got to keep the drug war going for TV or information reasons, which are a form of intimidation once you impose that problem and conflict on viewers of television. That dialectic, that conflict, will be forever needed by television. So that's why it can't be legalized or completely wiped out. So that's why I would recommend the only way to change that situation would be to turn off television coverage of the whole situation, or turn off the TV environment, which is a pretty impossible thing to do. But that would change the context. As long as we have the TV context, then that war will continue. Just like cops, it's like police stations need statistics. They need convictions. And every cop has to go out and you know, deliver a certain number of tickets to look like they're in action, that they're looking busy.
So in the face of all this, does this mean that you're generally optimistic or pessimistic?
Well, I don't have, you know, a personal point of view. I'm basically an apocalyptic. I figure it's apocalyptic for every attitude. No attitude can really have a very long lifespan, and no value can have a long lifespan, no matter what side you're on, and no group can, and no individual can survive media hypnotism like what Hillary Clinton's going through now. So we're all in an apocalyptic situation, which you sort of can't be optimistic or pessimistic about. You're right in it. We're in a situation that's quite devastating to everybody. And I know from knowing people in the counterculture, many people who take Dennis Hopper, they rose up in the 60s and early 70s, and then they went through a personal apocalypse. You know, they went into drugs, or they got in trouble, or they ended up in some kind of pain. And you hear a lot through People magazine of the pain that people had at a certain point in their life after they were famous. They may be being brought back now and recycled, but that pain is the inevitable apocalypse that will come to every person involved in the media culture we're in.
Well, speaking of being brought back and recycled, how do you feel about that on a larger level in terms of the theory of reincarnation?
What do I think of the theory itself?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I think that we have such an information overload that people lose their memories. Therefore, everything has a sense of deja vu, and I think that the popularity of the reincarnation idea and Oriental thinking is inevitable in American culture. I think that that will become a general trend, that people will believe in reincarnation because they're actually experiencing it through the media overload. Edmund Carpenter talks about this in his book, Oh, What a Blow That Phantom Gave Me, which was based on talking to many kids when he taught in California in the late 60s. They often would go to Japan or different places and felt they'd been there before, but they hadn't realized they'd seen those scenes on movies in the 40s and 50s.
I remember that book had one of my favorite examples. It was a woman wheeling a baby carriage, and some stranger looks passes by and says, oh, what a beautiful baby. And the mother says, oh, you should see his picture.
Yeah, his photograph, right. That's the famous McLuhan Carpenter story.
But what I'm wondering, Bob, is I remember reading something about you having been involved in channeling. So,
that's the story by Connie Dobbs. She said that I started the channeling move, the New Age movement, in the 70s in California. And that is true, but I personally don't channel myself. I just considered that I had predicted, and just by predicting that channeling would surface in the 80s as a big popular phenomenon, I had given the causes, which was the computer environment. If you look at my charts on the second album, I have the computer environment subsumes the universe, which is not only this physical dimension but other dimensions, putting them into a crisis. So the astral plane starts plunging into our dimension to try to maintain its mythic stage or its sense of stability. So many people become prone to channeling these other dimensions. And I think that's due to the computer and the electric environment in general blitzing us, which has come to the extreme now of people like Hans Moravec saying that, you know, when we get into advanced stages of virtual reality, they'll be able to download your soul or your mind and keep that going and then maybe rebuild some limbs for you. That would be the extreme of that.
Well, you know, I after I finished the autobiography, I started, in order to avoid the postpartum blues, I started work on a novel. And one of the characters in it does past life therapy through hypnotic age regression. And so I interviewed a past life therapist, and I said, well, how do you know that what these people are saying under hypnosis that they remember is an absolute truth or just something that they're making up from a combination of images and experiences? And he said, it doesn't make any difference. It works, which is everything that that they always say from Scientology to the Catholic Church. It works. But you know, do you think there's a kind of expansion of that process of false memory that extends to a whole culture?
Yeah, I think that people do have many lives. I personally believe in or have my own personal experience of it, so I believe that we reincarnate. But I don't think that the people who are put through this past life regression therapy actually retrieve their particular lives all the time. They retrieve cultural expectations or cultural effects of today. The thing is that the main desire put in by this mixed corporate media satellite environment is that everybody wants an audience, and they'll take any audience. So the birth or the explosion of the human potential or new age therapies, which got a lot of people who are not certified by regular medical schools offering certain therapeutic services in different from different schools of thought, the past life regression being one of them. They are meeting a felt need by people to have an audience. So the therapist is an audience for the person's strains and stresses of being discarnate, not having a body in an electric environment. And so I think that it works temporarily because people want to have that catharsis, almost as a metaphor for the apocalypse they're going through anyways. They want to act it out in some, like, anthropomorphic level of a noble or cathartic level that they understand from previous cultures or previous references. And they act that out for the therapist, and they feel relieved by it. This catharsis does that. But within 6 months, the electric environment has bombarded them and created more confusion that they need a new sense of having an audience for themselves. They have a new stress going on in themselves, and so they look for a new explanation. So you look over the last 15 years, you got all these different causes, from hypoglycemia up to incest, being temporary panaceas or anesthetics for people in this discarnate situation. So I agree that the past life therapy works temporarily, but not in the long run.
Well, listen, could you lend me $3,000 and I'll pay you back in your next lifetime?
I don't use the dealing money. That's the advantage of being on the Secret Council 10 is that I don't have any cash to lend. You know, the old joke about Rockefeller, he has no change in his pocket. Well, that's actually true. I don't have any money. I've never had any money for 20 years.
Well, how did you pay your butler?
I never had to.
Oh, he didn't deal in money either.
No. When you live on the level I live on, you sort of got a perpetual diplomatic immunity.
Oh, where's the manual?
Well, the fatty community is the beginning. Fatty community, that book is the first chapter in the oncoming manual of Lockdown Bob Rule.
Well, you know...
Now, what do you think of that idea that it works, and people do feel that if it works, they want to bypass the bureaucratic regulations like the FDA? There's many people who believe they can cure AIDS and have proof within their immediate experience with several people.
Well, in the issue of The Realist that's now at the printer, there's an article on people who drink their own urine. And there was, and this was a friend and I went to a meeting, a support group for people who drink their own urine. And
you mean it was a joke or just...
No, this was an actual group of people, about a dozen people.
But you went to just as a journalist to look at it.
Right, right. And and there was one man there who had AIDS and said he cured himself of it from drinking his own urine. And I think that's, you know, if I had to think of the most important discovery in my seeking that I've learned, it's that whatever people do works. I have a Donald Duck with eight arms, and I prayed to that for a long while, and it worked. You know, whatever people do, it works for them. Sometimes they may become New Age junkies and, you know, go to workshop after workshop and see guru after guru, but whatever they do works for them. There's a book that you might be interested in called The Guru Papers, The Masks of Authoritarian Power by Joel Kramer and Diana Alstead, which is a terrific intellectual analysis of the methods that people in position of authority use and how others kowtow to those manipulative ways.
Yeah. Well, I think that that is what's in the electric environment we have today. Then there will be much demobilizing of a standard consciousness. So people will be, in basic terms, hallucinating and creating their own realities, making their own sense. And I think that's been happening for 20 years, and I think the counterculture was the beginning of that. That is what happens to people privately. The problem is that language is what we all share, and I think each technological environment is an extension of language, and we don't know how to connect our private awareness to the public awareness, and the public awareness is expressed through language and the media. The media environments we use. And we got to learn how to talk about the media environment when we're on it. It's like a code word, a code language, so that you are not talking your personal point of view or what works for you. Because the FDA is responsible for all this industrial heritage of pharmaceutical companies that employ millions of people that, you know, dump the antibiotics on us, which are now being revealed to not be that effective. That environmental heritage that we've made, that language, that technology, has to be related to the new situation where people in the electric environment and being discarnate and having no sense of one body want to make up their own sense of what their body is, and that incorporates all kinds of therapies. Therefore, there's a very hyper-subjective situation where people can cure themselves through their own particular perceived methods. But how do we relate that private awareness dissembling, or private awareness schizophrenia, or hypersubjectivity, whatever you want to call it, the fact that our private awareness is allowing us to contain multitudes, in relation to the media environments we all share, which are our collective crowd dynamic that goes on in general in the evolution of mankind. You know?
But even that's changing because of the information superhighway with 500 channels where everything gets more and more specialized. So, you know, there'll be a channel for people who build model airplanes out of their toenails. So that shared reality you're talking about is becoming coleslaw.
Yeah, now that's the interesting thing, is that the idea that the collective imposes patterns on you has been changing as we came into the mosaic image of television and computers and the privatization of electric reality, which we're into now. There means that the crowd dynamic itself is a hallucinating idiot or a fragmented idiot. So there's where we might get the Victorian sensibility retrieved, because we're going to want to impose a collective dictatorial image on people through the media we have, because the electric crowd, the electric language, the electric media we live in, is fragmenting itself. See, there's the paradox we got. So whereas many kids will respond to Terrence McKenna and go for that ideology, or Anton Wilson, or Wired magazine, and Mondo 2000 magazine, ideologically people will feel their experience resonates with that. The problem is that they're responding to the technological fragmented environment and are taking advantage of it, but they don't know that the crowd dynamic, they call it in semiotics the other will need to impose a balance on that. And so people will project, maybe this is what Rush Limbaugh is. He's not now, he's the future. It's the retrieval of very, old American values. Will be, because people will want to feel there's something outside of themselves. That's the dilemma we get with technology, is it fragments us.
So that, does that mean that feminazis will drink orange juice or not?
Yes, it does.
Well,
it does. They will or not. I don't want to be arbitrary, but feminazis.
I had quotes around that from old Rush.
You had what?
That's a Rush Limbaugh term. I would never use it.
You put quotes around that.
Sardonic.
Well, I think that feminazis, to break that point down, feminazis will never drink orange juice because they've got to maintain their mythic stage that they think orange juice is made up of Rush now. And Rush will never give in to them, so that dialectic will go on for a long time. But it's the feeling that, Rush Limbaugh's appearance on Hearts of Desire for the first time in several years got a higher rating than Murphy Brown's show.
Well, you and I both watch it, and I never saw that show before.
Neither.
So I don't know what that proves, except that people are curious for new contexts.
Well, there's a dynamic there. There's a conspiracy to make Rush seem so popular that that's a mandate, and maybe he should run for president, even though he won't, and all this stuff. So it's like the Republican Party's last gasp is to get this popularity of a Rush Limbaugh image out there for the 96 election. There's that, and then there's also the people themselves. Under this feeling that the information superhighway will just inundate us with useless variety and fragmentation, that they feel the need to impose a new stability in this fragmenting order, so they support Rush Limbaugh, and that's registered through the pollsters. So you got two factors going on there, the conspiracy plus the bottom-up need, which are inevitable as long as you have this new technological environment coming along, so that you can predict, and this is what McLuhan did, you can predict what's going to be popular. In the 60s, you could. In the 70s, in the 80s, and the 90s, based on the technological dynamic. Maybe you can't predict who's going to be Rush Limbaugh, but you know that kind of situation will happen, of a Rush Limbaugh. I call them holeopathic retrievals. So, and I think that I know personally that the NSA and people use McLuhan and use this information to modulate the what I call tetrad management. They foresee these effects, and they work with them. They use McLuhan's book, Laws of Media. And that's one thing, the counterculture, the left, the Bob Fass network, whatever you want to call it, they should be studying Laws of Media because that's how it's used on them. That material, it's not that I'm saying they should learn McLuhan and become Orthodox McLuhanites. I'm saying they're using Marshall McLuhan's material to orchestrate society.
As best they can.
Yeah. Now, but they know...
Well, what are your besides turning the TV off? Do you have any other subversive directions that people can take?
Not that I present in public. I only present that one theme in public because, as I say on my album, or the album that was made from my radio show, I didn't have much to do with the album. I say that we frustrate the need for the mass media to have content. And everybody, no matter what question is polled them, what topic, they say turn off the television to every situation. And therefore, Dan Rather will have to always broadcast this idea that every night, whatever problem, Bosnia, gun control, Rush Limbaugh, Paul Krasner, whatever the question is, the audience says, and the highest polls indicate the solution is to turn off television. And so they'd have to talk about themselves constantly. And I think that we're so decentralized from the old mass media like CBS, NBC, and ABC, that people will not feel threatened by pretending they're zombies and just spouting off this like cult notion of turn off TV, because they can go about their own business, do whatever they want to do. It's so decentralized. You see what I'm saying? So I say if I'm going to talk in the media, so I don't want to project my personal point of view, I just project this public mandate, this public myth of turn off television. That's all I'll say in public, no matter what question comes up.
There's a piece in the new issue of the Whole Earth Review about taking a, as an example the town that did shut off TV and saying how you can shut off TV in your own town. So, you know, the idea is spreading. But then, as you always say, how will we know it's happening unless we turn on the news?
Yes, and the other thing is that I think that that's another effect of the image of the information superhighway. I think people, they're feeling so freed up from the mass media imposition that happened in the 50s, 60s, and 70s due to their own VCRs and their answer machines, all these things that give them autonomy from the fact that Ed Sullivan used to be on at 8 or 9, and you had to watch it then. So you're freed up from that.
You know, I was talking to some college students about whether they were going to watch Conan O'Brien, and they said, well, to tell you the truth, at that time period, we used to watch David Letterman, and we got used to being tired at the end of Letterman. So now that Letterman is on an hour earlier, they go to bed after he's off.
Okay, now do you see the factors here? Is that to finish that point, people are so decentralized from the imposition of the mass media, as we understood it in the past, that they feel that they can turn it off. It doesn't affect them anymore. But they don't realize the economic basis of the fact that you need a standardized word-making the market coming out of Dan Rather or the White House, the standard position, the collective consensus, because as long as we have a money environment, money needs a gold standard, so it needs a gold standard of information, so the news has to be standardized. That's a factor. Then you've got young kids who are not as literate and fragmented by literacy as they were in the 19th century. Kids who read literacy is only, or engage in literacy is only one medium among many, therefore have a bias to share a shared environment in a tribal way. They will stick to David Letterman because that's a kind of group identity for people in the late teens, early 20s. That factor happens to people, especially in an acoustic environment like television sets up. So these all these factors that are influencing us that nobody takes in consideration in the public dialogue. Now, I don't say that Dan Rather should bring this up because he couldn't. It's like you just said. If we turn off TV, we'd know what the news are. We have this catch-22 situation where the information environment is us and is necessary. That's the paradox.
Okay, let's see. I would like you, well, if you were predicting what was happening in each decade, what in particular would you predict about sex in the 90s?
Well, then you'd predict all the different types of people on the planet now first. You got to break it down like demographics, right? So I think that you make certain predictions for teens now, you make predictions for baby boomers, you make predictions for Arabs, for Europeans, for Chinese. But you mean basically, and most people think in this terms, the American environment, right? When you ask me that question.
Although I guess it's inseparable now.
Yeah, it's a world environment.
If, you know, I think with the NAFTA agreement, didn't we ship them one of our lone nuts?
So, yeah, the American environment is becoming a world environment. I explain that as a nostalgia for kinetic space. I mean, satellite TV environment is tactile space, but kinetic space is America. That's the movie, car, and steel, or the environment of the end of the century, previous century, and into the 30s of America. That movie, radio, car environment is what everybody kind of wants as a little package spaceship capsule to live in around the whole world. You know, they call it the triumph of capitalism. So assuming the American environment is what everybody's going into, I know that we'll have many different trends. It's what the pollster guys think their major market is and what their interests are that determines which trend will be the one imposed on us and will be defined for as the trend of the 90s. All right? So assuming that there is, let's say, who would they project? Let's say it's an aging population. So the aging population of the United States will be the majority consumers, so the mainstream media would have to deal with them. The people in their 40s and 50s and 60s now, in all through the 90s, the major trend would be, also because they've been discarnate for 40 years, that they will have a basic disgust with the body while their kids wallow in the body via Terrence McKenna. But they'll have a general disgust, and we can see a general Victorian sensibility and a purification of bodily fluids, and maybe we could call a conservative trend, a basic emphasis that other things are sexy, not just sex. So I predict that people will find and continue to find channeling all the New Age things, as well as rediscovering books, rediscovering movies, rediscovering their cars. All these things will become sexy to people as they age. They'll invest their erotic fantasy life into objects, but not into the body. And people will say at the time, well, this is because of age, and age is still going and all that stuff. But I think there is another. If we didn't have AIDS, we'd still have that effect on an aging generation. One of the cliches of African-American culture is that they have a very free sexual life when they're young. But the black American, African-American people, when they get into their 40s, 50s, turn very religious and get very emotionally involved in their religion. And they produce great music out of that. But that pattern, the tribal culture historically of the African-American, may be what's going to happen to the general American population, the baby boomers as they age. You know what I mean? They become very religious or very emotionally involved in other things and actually have quite a Puritan attitude for themselves in relation to sex, but they'll be flexible towards kids. Most tribal societies have flexible elders and rigid youth, and rigid youth are very rigid about getting laid, and they want it, and they'll demand it, and they will get it, and the tribal elders allow that. But so the majority of Americans will go toward a flexible elder attitude, which could be what Clinton represents. He's the beginning of a new flexible elder. He's a liberal. He's in the position of authority, and the conservative image of Reagan and Bush does not meet the increasing tribalization of American culture.
Because he can still keep it rigid.
Beg your pardon?
Because he can still keep it rigid.
Well, he's rigid. He's supposedly very... He's like the reformed adulterer, right? I mean, we don't know on the public level what his personal life is, but the image is that he did some fooling around before. Now Hillary is his mother-wife kind of situation. She's the container, the repository of spiritual values, and it's almost like, you know, the matriarchy of tribal societies. So he maintains that reformed, repentant image for his age group, but he's flexible for young people. Do you see what I'm saying?
But then there's another media aspect of it, which is the weekly tabloids, because it's only in the weekly tabloids that you read that Hillary Rodham Clinton has banned Barbara Streisand from the White House, and the implications of that.
Yeah. Well, I'd say that the tabloids are a diversified market. They communicate to the general Puritan strain in American culture. What Norm Mailer said, the American's fascination with virtue. So that to play off that, the Puritan is fascinated with the sins of others. So the tabloids are niche marketing, and probably for young people who like to read it, because then it enhances their sexual explorations with a drama. And those maybe as they get older, in their 30s and 40s, are still not arrived at that stage I'm talking about where you get older and get religious. They are still fascinated because they're working, and they need to know if anybody else is having more fun than them. So there's a real cliche, nostalgic level of human envy, human desire that's played out in the tabloids. That's why they'll never go away, because I think a certain phase of a person's growth is attracted and fascinated by that kind of information.
Huh?
Saying?
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned Mae Brussels before. Had you ever met her?
Yes, I knew Mae for a long time.
People who don't know, Mae Brussels was a conspiracy researcher who I think
she was the greatest conspiracy researcher.
I think so. I think she was, there's a certain competitiveness among conspiracy researchers like in any other field. And they often call each other agents, and they bring paranoia into a fine art along with their findings. But, you know, you can't do that kind of research often without being affected by it.
Yeah, to get affected by that stigma of just being a conspiracy theorist.
I think, and Mark Lane just did an introduction to a book by the most unlikely, the guy who... Oh, I guess it was the guy who said that the Holocaust didn't exist, and I guess
all kinds of them. Who is the most recent?
Let's see.
An American?
Yeah, I forget his name, but it's not Steven Spielberg.
Well, you know, May told me, she used to point out whenever, and it was reported to her occasionally, Mark Lane, whenever the Kennedy thing came up, like in 1983, the 20th anniversary, he'd get on, and whatever talk shows he was on, if Mae Brussels' name came up, he would say May was crazy. He'd always put May down. So May was always suspicious of Mark Lane. But it wasn't that she was saying that about him publicly, he said it about her.
Yeah, and she had a certain breathless quality about her that and was had so many so much data to spew out that people could come away with that impression. But I remember that Seymour Hersh at the Washington Post told me when I sent him her material, he said, and she had called him, and he said, she's crazy, but she's right.
Yeah, now what period? Early 80s?
Now, this would have been 72.
Oh, the first Watergate period that was
right.
your article.
Right.
Yeah, well, she talked to Hersh all through those years into the 80s and much of Penny Larneau's books in Banks We Trust and books like that. May was onto that first, you know, in the early 80s. The thing about May is that she wasn't always right about the details, but she could pick up the pattern, and the pattern would maybe at least be 80% correct. And she was on that, whatever news happened over from 1972 to 1988. She was always on top of it.
But I'll bet she couldn't have predicted that there would be Charlie Manson T-shirts.
Yeah, I sent May some McLuhan literature, because I think Marshall's book, Take Today, The Executive's Dropout, came out in 72, and Marshall told me this, was about the sort of secret society, the conspiratorial nature of power. That's what they addressed in that book. And, of course, they weren't as linear as May, and they brought in the effects of technological environments on conspiratorial power. So it was a whole new way of looking at it. And I sent that stuff to May, and she said to me, I can't understand it. And I think it's because May never couldn't take the time to do it. She was smart enough if she took the time to do it, but she was obsessive in what she did, but it served a role. She had a role, which, you know, many people try to find in the global theater. What's my role? What can I do that I kind of can be appreciated for in media coverage? People know I'm doing it, and yet I enjoy doing it. Now, she wasn't covered extensively, but she was known, you know, thanks to you. And occasionally you would write articles about her, like in We Magazine or something, and she would be reminded on a public level. So she knew she was a public figure. So she had a role, so she had to kind of stick to that point of view and that way of researching pattern recognition about power. It's just like in my role, I emphasize media ecology or turning off TV, and that's my public stance in relation to all the other stances. But it's not what I privately am obsessed about, you know, personally. And I think that was a great thing about May, is that she could keep on, she worked hard every day at it, but she had such an exciting life on her own, privately and sensuously involved with her family and friends and new lovers or whatever she did, that she could keep going and be happy privately. You know what I mean?
Right, but and there. Oh,
wait. We'll return in a moment with a dialogue between Bob Dobbs and Paul Krasner.
Welcome back to Contemporary Communications Conference. My name is Jerry Fielka. Today we're speaking with Paul Krasner, who is the publisher of The Realist, and whose current book is entitled "Confessions of a Raving Unconfined Nut: Misadventures in the Counterculture," as well with Bob Dobbs, who published the newsletter The Perfect Pitch and has authored the book Phatic Communion with Bob Dobbs. Go ahead, Bob.
Continuing this, we ended off with me eulogizing May in the way she lived her private life as opposed to her public role. I want to know if Paul agrees with that perception, and then would he comment on the effect of the chapter about May presents May in overall as a problem for Paul, or that she was a cult, or it kind of makes May, I think it diminishes May, taking in consideration that in the information swill that was going on in the late 60s, early 70s, it was hard for anybody to not create a cult effect if they had some dynamic pattern recognition. Okay, with that statement, Paul, can you respond?
Yeah, your point is well taken, because I deliberately left a certain ambiguity in that chapter, because what I wanted to point out was that somebody as brilliant and dedicated as May could still get to a point where she was not open-minded. And the specific example I used was that she was, because she saw everything through the filter of conspiracy, she was convinced that Robert De Niro and Robin Williams were part of a conspiracy to kill John Belushi, because they had snorted cocaine with him the previous night.
Yes.
And And I tried to explain to her that that wasn't so. And then I mentioned that after she died, I learned that there had been a sting operation planned by the Los Angeles Police Department against De Niro and Robin Williams and John Belushi. And that Police Chief Daryl Gates, this was his personal project, and that he was more saddened by John Belushi's death than others because it meant that he missed a great photo opportunity.
Is that a published record, that rumor or that story or that fact?
I mentioned it, I think, in the caption under May's photo in my book.
Right.
But the thing is, what was interesting to me is that the point I was trying to make in that was that as incredible a researcher that May was, that she could go wrong and that it is cult-like never to challenge anybody who happens to be in that guru-like position. But the irony is somebody read that caption and they said, and when they saw that there had been this sting operation planned, they said, aha, see, May was right. So,
she wasn't completely right, but she was aware of something.
Yeah.
On there. It's like,
but when I talked about, May did nothing to me, what I was talking about was my own, falling into that kind of cult-like thinking where you forget to differentiate between coincidence and conspiracy.
Yeah. So that she would even, she would agree that you projected that on her. You think she would agree that you projected?
Well, I would be curious to know. You know, there are people who think that that May did not that May was murdered, and just as they think Abby Hoffman was murdered.
Yes.
And there was a time when I would have automatically thought that, but I try to deal with each incident issue by issue.
Well, I know personally that May was greatly satisfied in 82. By what came out with John Loftus on 60 Minutes, the whole Bolero secret stuff and the Nazi stuff from 82 and in the P2 Society, the Vatican stuff, all that stuff that came out in 82, 83, her general drift, which she spells out in your first article for The Realist, was confirmed, that the Nazi connection, and it had become sort of a mainstream topic. So she felt satisfied that that part of her work, which was a big part, was confirmed.
Oh, absolutely, but there was also the side of her, when I was roommates for...
I wanted to follow that. By 85, 86, she was very tired, and she was tired of beating a dead horse in a certain sense that most people did not want to understand what May had learned, what she had predicted, and what had been confirmed. So she wanted to withdraw from that public role. But because of the Challenger going down and that strawberry genetic stuff in her area, she was forced in 86 to carry on continuing being May in Brussels, though she was tired and wanted to take a break and read some other things, and that, I think, weakened her health. And I think that led to the cancer. So the story about May, the way she was in 1988, that she was still on the radio, still pumping away, had other factors that unfortunately led to her death. I don't think she was murdered.
No, neither do I, nor do I think Abby Hoffman was murdered. But there are people who want to think that for their own reasons of their own perspective.
Yeah.
But
I think that May was that's what was so great about knowing her privately. There was such a, and she was a Gemini, so she could be kind of schizoid, but she was very, you know, the private part of herself was aware of all these situations, and she herself did not want to be a cult. But the effect of her information for someone just getting involved in it inevitably creates a certain awe and hypnotism, and it's also hard on the mind.
Yeah, but there were points where the crossover between her personal and private life, because my daughter was good friends with her daughter, and she would warn me, she said, they're going to kidnap your daughter, you know.
Yeah.
She was capable of instilling that kind of paranoia. When I was going to become roommates with Stuart Brand, she said, he's a government pig, you know, don't do it. And in a sense, I defied my guru and became roommates with him. I asked her, I said, well, am I in physical danger? And she said, no, he'll just try to psych you out. So she did have that level of thinking where, but as you said, she did have her own personal and private passions.
Yeah, but
just as you, on one, you know, you say that telling people to shut off their TV is your public
right
persona, but, you know, I'd be curious about what your own private passions and obsessions are.
Well, we could go into that, but the thing about May is that it reminds me of what Marshall said, that when he was criticized for sort of the idea that the medium as a message is it's a half-truth. You're emphasizing this half-truth too much. He would say, well, for most people, a half-truth is a lot of truth.
Uh-huh.
And I think that applies to Mae Brussels. It was a three-quarters truth, let's say. She didn't have it down who actually organized Lee Harvey Oswald to do what he did, but she had the general pattern, so it was like a three-quarter truth. And then and that's a lot of truth for people. And then, as part of being doing a show and wanting to, I think it's human, to interest people and intrigue and stimulate people, she had to keep coming up with patterns. And I think she did get exaggerated in things like Stuart Brand, but that's because she felt, and she told me this personally, she did not like the fact that there was a patriarchal situation in journalism in the 70s. They did not like the fact that they were biased against her because she was a woman, that all these people, including the counterculture, did not sort of learn what she had to say in detail. They wouldn't really study it. And so if she had a resentment against Leary and these people in the counterculture because she thought they took them away from her. Now, that's a megalomaniac attitude, but she, in retrospect, had so much good information she should have been listened to a little more.
But, you know, it was like she had been gathering facts in the vineyard, and then it was like then she'd give people the orange concentrate.
Yeah.
And it was information overload for people. They were not prepared for that.
And that's the irony of a person who becomes excellent at some discipline or some situation. How do you, it's either in your nature to spend the time to become really good at something, how do you sort of hand that on to someone else who may not have the same drive without wrecking them? That's like the problem of teaching. I remember the Ripoff Press put out this Mobius strip of conspiracy, and one of the factors of conspiring against this, it was done by
Paul Mavrides,
Cisco,
and Jay Kinney, I think, too, right?
Yes.
Jay Kinney, who's the other one, the friend of
Mavrides.
Paul Mavrides, right? They did it, and one of the conspiratory factors was your child's brain. Your child is, the next generation. You've got to teach them what you're interested in, what you're good at, and you have to impose that on a person. On a group of people and how their talents will be projected into that situation. How do you pass on any knowledge? That's what I find is a paradox, is that Mae had this incredible stuff that she was, by circumstance, inclined to learn and become a genius at. How do you pass that on to someone else if you acknowledge that everybody has their own reality and they have their own interests and their own obsessions? And how could they even begin to take the time to study it like Mae? So she's left hanging like everybody is. Einstein or McLuhan or any geniuses are left hanging in the wind.
Oh, but people screen themselves in.
Screen?
Yeah, that people who are interested in that get through that screen that stops others.
Yeah, but they might adapt, but they cannot see what Mae sees with her expertise. So they might muddle it, and then she would complain about how she always complained about a lot of the Brussels sprouts. How they presented. I mean, she even complained to me about you in different times.
I'm sure she did.
Yeah, and so that she was communicating to people and who were interested, but they never got it the way she did or had the time to do the work. So it was almost like your information was obsolete. It could not be passed on. That's what I think is a big problem in communication.
Well, sometimes people understood what she was saying and it made them feel helpless. You mean it's that bad?
Right, but also if they brought it up in conversation, they didn't have the background, they didn't have the material at their fingertips, and so they sort of looked foolish if they started to bring it up. They kind of knew Mae knew it, but how do they translate it since they didn't have all the background? I guess it's the solipsistic attitude that we all have the contents of our own head. How do we pour our contents into someone else's head?
Well, that's the challenge of communication. As a stand-up comedian, I find that that's the challenge there to communicate, it's an audience of people with of diverse backgrounds, and at the moment they laugh at something I say, that means for that moment they're united.
Right.
So that's the challenge of any kind of communication.
And maybe Mae did not understand that enough, that people could sort of hallucinate our stuff and take it another direction. She was almost, what do you call that, a literalist. She wanted them to get exactly what she saw, and maybe that's where she was a little too forceful.
It was, and then I became like that, and I compared myself to the ancient mariner, slogging my filthy albatross in their faces.
Yeah, well, I quote from the ancient mariner at the beginning of my book.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you can look at that. The ancient mariner is a fantastic metaphor.
And I've never even seen an albatross. Just have to take his word for it.
Well, the famous line that I use is from The Ancient Mariner is, we were the first to break into that silent sea. When you get, I mean, May saw the horror, just like Kurtz in Apocalypse Now, she saw the horror, but how can you pass it on to anybody else? How does anybody really want to, do they have the yoga, the strength of mind to look at it? And so she was stuck in the situation of not being able to communicate the intensity of horror that she saw, or that people were willing to see it. So she had broken into that silent sea. And then I think that slips into people becoming, as public figures, role-playing exaggerators of their point, because they kind of feel it's futile to get it across anyway, so why not just sort of beat them over the head with it?
Or retire totally.
Yeah, which she wanted to do in the middle 80s. That's a little known fact.
Well, this is, I think, true of a lot of visionaries. I mean, I think that that's true of Neil Cassidy. It was expected of him that he hold court, and therefore he held court, and then it became an interactive process that he responded to what he thought was expected of him, and because he did it, it was expected of him.
Yeah, and you're saying he wanted to retire? That's when he walked down the tracks.
Right. Well, not necessarily, but I mean, you know, sometimes you become what the persona that you've been putting up front, so that even if you resent holding court, it becomes almost like an addiction.
Okay, did you have that problem ever?
I found it hard to say no. If I got invited to speak somewhere, I would say yeah. I felt like I was defying fate if I didn't.
Yeah, so you'd beat Paul Craster.
Yeah, yeah.
Image. Well, how do you feel? You've brought back the realist. Aren't you being retrieving Paul Krasner now?
But I'm doing it more on my own terms now, you know. So if I get invited to speak at one place, I may turn it down and I may accept another one. I mean, I'm just doing it more on my own terms. But the only reason you have I have my name on it is because it's a symbol.
Yeah.
And if I put somebody else's name on... Originally, I wasn't going to call it The Realist, and I thought, no, it already has a reputation. I should take advantage of that fact. But, as Ken Kesey said, he thought of his image and his energy as two different entities, that his energy is what he did, and his image is what other people thought he did.
Right. So I would say that there is a realization by now, by the baby boomers, let's say, the idea of projecting your image over the mass media, when it was a one-way situation in the 50s and 60s, people are less keen on doing that and are accepting of what you've just said about yourself. You're more autonomous in terms of your public image. You don't have a great desire to project it over, because the decentralized electric media now makes people see that it's very hard to impose any one pattern on a situation, and actually it's very hard to build an image.
Well, you know, I faced that paradox when I went on my book tour. Because, you know, you want to reach as many people as possible. But and so the publicist for Simon & Schuster was told by the producers at the Arsenio Hall show and the Jay Leno show and the Tonight Show. They said, well, look, Arsenio loves Paul's work. Jay loves Paul's work. But our pipeline is so clogged up with celebrities now that we don't have time for anybody who might have something to say. So I did end up on the Conan O'Brien show at 1:25 in the morning right after the bruised fruit fight.
But you probably would have been more angry about that in 1970 than now, because you're not interested and the technology doesn't make you feel fascinated by projecting your image over all of America now. You're willing to be a fragmented enterprise.
Well, I turned myself into a commodity in order to let people know about the book existing. That's true. But there was an experience I had which put it all in perspective, because I was supposed to do a reading in downtown New York right after the Conan O'Brien show was taped. So NBC provided a limousine to take me there. And when I came out of the building, there was a small crowd gathered around because they saw a limo outside NBC. They figured it must be a celebrity.
Yeah.
So this woman came up to me and asked for my autograph. And then she said, do you mind if I have my picture taken with you? So I said, okay. So this guy with a camera posed us. And we put our arms around each other, because that's what a camera gives you permission to do, to put your arm around a stranger. And this guy's taking our picture. Another man is walking by. He sees me and this woman having our picture taken in front of a limo by NBC. He figures there must be a celebrity there, so he asks the woman for her autograph. And I'm being taken away in a limo, and I see she's signing it. So that put the whole image thing in perspective, definitely. But I think that in terms of but that's because I've experienced a lot, and I know that it has nothing to do with me. Whereas there's like 17 talk shows now where people, they get 2,000 calls a week and letters from people who want to be on, who want to have their public exorcism. And
a good phrase, public exorcism.
Yeah, I think it's taken the place of confession.
Okay, now that is people who weren't part of the... I think the changes happened up till, say, 1977. There's no changes after that. Everything's disappeared.
Why 1977?
You can look at my chart. That's a whole other topic.
Okay.
Jerry can show you the charts. But the situation is that the revolutions, and Baudrillard writes about this, he says, what do we do after the orgy? Well, there was an orgy of public archetypes in the 1670s, and then they exhaust themselves. I think that those who had intelligence, those who had energy, were attracted and were involved in that. But I think that many people who were born, let's say, in the 60s are now in their 20s or late 30s or early 30s, they... and this is a natural progression. Some until maybe they have to be about 40 to understand the effects of all the different media environments we live in. So the younger people still believe there's an environment out there to match with, to communicate on a mass level. So they want to get on. Then there's those who were older and were part of and weren't that intelligent or media savvy. They still have this need to be part of this revolution from their point of view of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and they want to get on now. And they think if they discover some little piece of information or some pattern, not knowing that information is obsolete, pattern recognition is obsolete now because everything's disappeared, they still believe in their blooming world and they want to get on. So that's why you have this endless supply of suckers to get on to do their public exorcism.
So before 1977, as Andy Warhol said, everybody wanted their 15 minutes of fame. After 1977... everybody wants to be the person of the week on ABC News. I think that's the difference. The 15 minutes isn't enough. They want worldwide recognition.
Yeah, now that could be the effect of the mixed corporate media, global satellite situation that affected the beatniks and the hippies and the yippies in a more subliminal way. It's now a figure. It's well known that you have access to the whole world, and CNN has the image of the satellite, you, the satellite, flying around the planet during their news shows at the beginning, the logo. The young kids, if they grow up today knowing they can project themselves over the whole planet, they also do it with a sense of irony. And I think Kurt Cobain is that. He may have killed himself as this whole thing about him being miserable may have been a put-on by him.
Well, that's the ultimate put-on then.
Right. And this kind of state makes people do suicide as the last narcissistic act of the ego, because people are pretty convinced that we live in other dimensions now, that they believe in reincarnation. So, well, I'll just do this lifetime as an art form. So the thing is that the fact that right now media ecology is like a feeling among people that they want to shut off the media, the young people star for that, Kurt Cobain, he objected to the media fame, to the projection of himself all over the planet. But there are still people who want to do with it, but they want to play with it. It's not as important now to do it and really believe in it. You just do it as a game and with a sense of irony. And that's one thing about the slacker generation, is they have a great sense of irony or media irony. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's why they appreciate David Letterman.
And the realist. I think they understand and respond to that ironic part of the counterculture that you are, you know, revitalizing with the realist. I think that attitude would be more acceptable on a broader level by kids than they would have been in the 60s. Because of that media sense of irony, I take this quote from Finnegan's Wake, James Joyce, page 169. He says, putting truth and untruth together, a shot may be made at what this hybrid actually was like to look at. What it's like to look at our media world today. You put truth and untruth together. That's the realist.
I think the government, the media have become sort of, I guess, the fourth branch of government.
Yeah, they are the government. They're what I mean in my video, the word makes the market. It's very important. The information runs the situation, and the information is centralized. And it is based on polls, paradoxically, based on what people think they're afraid of or what they need. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. The audience rules, but it's transmitted through the medium of news.
But here's how cynical it gets. Because
cynical. It's really cynical. That's the point.
So even the producers of the David Letterman show, if they find that let's say there's an action movie like Die Hard on earlier that evening on that channel, then they'll be more likely to book an Evanda Holyfield than a Mary Tyler Moore to get that carryover of the audience for numbers.
Yeah, and with speed, with the electric speed, you can do that. You can organize your resources really fast. The main point about the information environment is that we have to realize that the audience feeds on itself, and that that television is like nature. It's like the sun. It's always going to come up. Once a society starts to use electric media, it's like nature. It will want to be used 24 hours a day. So there'll always have to be something on the electric environment. People turn on not really for what is on the media, but to experience that electric discarnate space, which is television itself, that vibrating, resonating dimension that television, you feel, is communicating, resonating with everybody else that's watching it. So that is a psychotic, obsessive need that we have once we have the television environment. So therefore, we have to have content on it all the time. So therefore, everything becomes content. That's Warhol's prediction. And every artifact then gets exhausted because it's by the middle 70s, everything has been played out. Then you've got to do it with a sense of irony or detachment and keep the content going, but in saying this is ridiculous, keeping the content going. That's what Letterman played up. So the hidden ground is the need for always television to keep going with content.
And it's not just TV, though. It's,
electric media.
Computer bulletin boards, faxes. Steve Allen said that satire is tragedy plus time, but everything has accelerated so much now that the time sequence has gone to, it's on the cusp of, it's almost
there's no time.
Been erased. So that even, it used to be, there used to be at least a space differential so that people would make jokes easier about the Chernobyl disaster than they did about the Challenger disaster because that was closer to home.
Right.
Whereas by the time the cult in Waco occurred, they were doing jokes about it on faxes and radio shock jocks. Even while it was occurring, they were doing jokes about it.
So that we've exhausted. See, people have exhausted the long-lasting content. All the images of movements and whatever has run its course, and they've been exhausted. What McLuhan called the rise and fall of cliches. Now we're 10 years. You could say this is part of what's disappeared after 1977. We're replaying it, and we're also imploding that we've exhausted everything. All the Phil Donahue talk shows. So right to tomorrow, we're going to turn on the news, and we're going to want something on there. And everybody is now looking more and more to that new thing that they can use because they've used everything else. So we're imploding. That's a reverse effect of this decentralized electric media, is that we are going more and more to a centralized need for a new image, and we're all going to use it. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. My friend Scoop Nisker, who was the news director of a radio station in San Francisco, invented the phrase, if you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own.
Well, that's what by the 70s, the media relied on that. As a matter of fact, the counterculture was a content. They needed a content different from the 50s. And so the kids were making their own identity crisis, but the media made it a news item. And then by the 70s, everybody knew this, and everybody was making it. And now that comes back to your point that everybody feels that what they've made should be broadcast, and they're all applying to get onto talk shows.
Well, how will they know it exists otherwise? I mean, that's the electronic version of Bishop Berkeley's conundrum about if a tree falls in the forest and nobody's there to hear it. Now, if an event happens but the cameras aren't there to record it, did it actually happen?
Right, and most people who... This was a commonplace at the McLuhan Center in the 70s that it was known that the rioters or whatever in Northern Ireland would wait till the cameras were set up before they did their thing. And even Hugh Kenner has mentioned this in his literary criticism, the fact that by the 70s, TV and the event, the content, conspired together to do it with the best possibility. Now, how's that? Now, what did you said just before that Berkeley thing, how would we know? I'm talking about how people want to get on the media. They don't know it's disappeared in a certain sense. How do they, when you say they don't know what, how do they know it's there? What do you mean by that? Because that's true. It isn't there, but I don't get what you're saying. that they don't know it's there or not there.
Oh, isn't it a nice role reversal for you not to understand something somebody else is saying?
Well, no, that's what I need that thing going. I pretend I'm now in the audience. That keeps us going.
Well, there's a shared pretense. If you look at, say, a TV show that's being broadcast and the camera pans over the audience, the members of the audience pretend that the camera isn't on them, that they're really watching the stage.
Right.
Maybe a kid will break through that and stare back. A kid or a crazy person will stare back at the camera and stick out his tongue or something.
Right.
So there's this shared pretense, but you know, you just know that...
How does that relate to this, the Berkeley point?
Oh, that people, in, let's say, in anti-war demonstrations, that part of it was, the part of the success of it was measured by the media coverage of it.
Right.
And because people wouldn't know that
reality.
The what?
Coverage is reality. Now, that's what you mean. If it's not covered, then it's not real. That's the point you're...
Well, it's at least it's a goal if it's not a reality. I mean, a lot of demonstrations are held. I mean, watch C-SPAN. You'll see these senators talking, and they'll look around the room, but C-SPAN will show you there's nobody in the room.
That's right. No, the thing is that you're right. This is the point that coverage is real. This is where media, our languages, and not just, you know, television, but books and newspapers and all back through to speech, all needed, they all were real. We call it the second nature. It's human-made nature as opposed to original creator-made nature. It's what we made. It's a man-made situation. And I include all senses in men. So that we need, it becomes real, really real. And this is a linguistic problem. Then electric media requires us, it is real to us. Therefore, it has to cover. Our actions have to be translated into electric media, have to be broadcast. That is what's made the whole world a global theater. Especially with the satellite TV environment. That has made every one of us a desire for an audience. Now, this point relates back to a lot of the themes I was making, is that the need for an audience, when everybody's an actor, is implemented or embedded in us by the technological situation of the language we live in, which is the electric environment. So all these answers can be explained by the television situation, by the computer.
At the Chicago Convention in 68, when the Yippies and the other protesters were there, that's when the phrase "the whole world is watching" came into being.
Yeah,
I mean, we were saying out loud what other people's secret desires were.
That's right. That was my chart, and Jerry can show it to me. Explain why that happened in '68. Why that was the beginning of moving into the end of everything by '77. But yeah, that is an archetypal situation. The whole world was watching. You see, what the Yippies did, they did the opposite of Mortsaw. Mortsaw brought politics into the nightclub. The Yippies brought the nightclub into politics.
The funny thing is, that's the same phrase that Mortsaw used to put down Dick Gregory when he said that, when Mortsaw said about himself that he brought politics into the theater and that Dick Gregory was bringing the theater into politics.
Right. And, he could have been more accurate by saying that Gregory brought the nightclub into politics. But see, those all situations were merging under the satellite environment, which had been there for 10 years, since 57. So the Yippies. And that was Abbie Hoffman's first book, was all about how to use the media, or what he thought the media was, as well as to bring the nightclub into politics. He also was aware of bringing it into the global theater. And so the Yippies were more theatrical than the hippies, in a conscious sense. So that is why that phrase came out of that whole thing, because that was what was the hidden dynamic of the Yippie movement was. They knew the whole world was watching via media. They realized that media was a real force that we had to deal with.
Exactly. Now, there's only a little time left, and I know that Jerry had... one area he wanted us to get into.
Thanks. Is there hope for the future? A young reviewer wrote about Paul's book. I didn't know politics could be so fun. Where do I sign up? What constructive counsel do you guys suggest for the youth of today? Kurt Cobain quoted Neil Young in his suicide note, "It's better to burn out than to fade away." But Jean Cocteau saw the creative spirit as the highest form of the spirit of contradiction. Cocteau decreed his intention to obliterate the modern "do as you wish," the false freedom that is taught to American children, which deprives young people, heroes and artists, of their essential motivation, disobedience.
Well, I think that's just a big sack of cliches that have no relevance, especially because you had to say it in English, which is a cliche medium. Now, for talking in the media, I would tell kids that creativity is obsolete. And then when you realize that if something's obsolete, it works. In other words, it can be used. It's no longer the hidden real dynamic on your consciousness. The hidden environment is always invisible. So if creativity is obsolete, I mean that it's not the real constituent factor in your consciousness. The media needs content, so they want more creativity. They want more words, poetry, music, baseball, whatever, all kinds of anthropomorphic expression. They need that, especially with the superhighway. So if you want to be an anti-environment to that situation where creativity is obsolete and therefore will be the content and endlessly plumbed for titillation, then how do you do an anti-environment to that? And I would say to study my situation of Bob's Mediacology, whenever you have to interact with general media, be a zombie. But you are free to study whatever you want on your own and be creative personally. But don't think that creativity is going to create a change. Creativity keeps the windmills of Satan going.
Well, I think that creativity is change by its very nature.
And change is our daily reality.
Yeah, that it's a constant. My wife gets shocked at some of the things she sees on TV, and I keep saying, well, what do you expect it to be, stagnant?
Well, that's another way of saying that the media needs new content, because the media has to be kept on, and people want to live in that discarnate cyberspace of television. They want to be part of it every day. So every form of human expression will be used and exploited and expressed. So you can do that play game. That's where each one of us is both figure and ground. You can put out a book and revitalize the realist and know that some of you can make money out of it and you might make some money out of it. At the same time, you can also ignore the effects of all that and have a different public stance when you're required to talk about public issues. We both are every one of us on this planet is in a yin-yang situation. We're creating our own disease as well as solving it.
Well, I guess, so then creativity isn't obsolete then.
That's right. Obsolescence means that it can be used and it doesn't rock the boat. It's accepted, becomes a guaranteed environment. The hidden environment is a thing that's really motivating everybody and creating a lot of obsession or neurosis, and the stress of life is always caused by the new invisible environment. Therefore, an antidote or an anesthetic to that is the past environments, and use that as a prop. So all human creativity is now provided as the content of the mixed corporate media's as its content, but the mixed corporate media, it creates the stress on people that they're trying to find out and express how that stress is affecting them. And they'll never be able to express how that stress is affecting them. All they have to do is just understand what I'm talking about.
Well, but, you know, there are New Age resorts like Esalen where executives go, but it's an elitist kind of thing because they can afford to go there. And so what it means is they can go fire an employee, but put their hand on his shoulder as they fire him.
Yeah, with sympathy or with some empathy.
Right.
Well, yeah, every movement, even any form of awareness, from visionary to, say, individualistic genius, any form, even stupidity, all forms of awareness are obsolete. They can be used as content. So Esalen didn't know, Michael Murphy and those guys didn't know that they would become a big deal and then they would be obsolete. Then it'd be retrieved. And therefore they sort of have their meaning within that situation, how they exploit it or whatever they do.
But they realize that now they're trying to say, okay, what do we do after process?
Right. And process is there's a good word, because process is what is affecting all of us. That's the hidden ground, is process. And they just reflected subconsciously the need for psychology to adapt to the new electric environment in the 1670s, the electric environment being process, so they came up with concepts of process. Now, that concept is obsolete because they've exhausted it. People are no longer used to it, but they're stuck in an environment that is process incarnate. So they got a problem. And
well,
I really think on a public level, my explanations get people out of that metaphorical problem.
And yet you're still hopeless.
Right. I'm a lost cause.
Uh-huh. But you're having fun.
That's right. That's ironic. And that's how we have
to... I guess that would be my advice to young people. Have fun, which is obviously superfluous advice. If they have to hear it from me, you know, then they're in a pretty sad state.
Well, first of all, we tell them they're in an apocalyptic situation. And then we...
In case they don't know.
Yeah. No, they know it, but they don't know how it got to the situation. So obviously, they read my liner notes. They understand how it got here. In my liner notes, I spell out very good sources like Mae Brussel and McLuhan and Finnegan's Wake and LaRouche and Zappa and different people. It covers the whole spectrum. You look at that stuff. Take the time. Because you're going to be saturated by television by the time you're 18 or 19. You want to know what to do. You want to develop an identity. Study something that is taking the best of what's happened in the last 40, 50 years. You study that. Then you realize that the understanding that you got from that is obsolete. And then that's the apocalypse. So that you don't exist. You have to deal with the fact you live in almost an oriental oblivion. You live in a void. There isn't any void. You don't exist. Once you realize that, that in terms of expressing that in relation to anybody else, because that's what language is, expression. Once you realize you were gone, you were invisible, then you realize, I'm still here. Then you start to realize you've survived. So you got to tell them they're dead, everything's disappeared, you got to tell them how it happened that way, and then they'll go through the hallucination of that language and that insight, and then they'll realize, like a Zen thing, that they're still here. First there is a mountain, then there's no mountain, then there is a mountain. But we can't use Zen language anymore. We can't use any discipline's language. We have to use the language of the situation we're in now, which no culture has ever dealt with. That's how I begin.
I think when the anthropologists dig us up, they'll think that our credo was stay tuned.
our credo?
Yes.
Yeah, stay.
Our belief system could be summed up in the phrase stay tuned.
Yeah, now you mean that. You're saying that seriously. Or
well, I think, well, in a certain sense, yeah. I mean, if you study the media, as you and I seem to do, you realize that they constantly try and program the audience with fear, either fear that their armpits will smell or fear that they'll miss something if they turn it off.
Yeah. Okay, but that's because the electric space. Now, you're right. The term stay tuned, if you look at it in the four levels of causality that I began with, if you look at that as a multi-leveled statement that has apocalypse and salvation within it, then that's a good logo. Because we're forced to stay tuned today. You have to have like a yoga. You got to be able to live in the state of being constantly attuned to what's happening, and you've got to learn what your relationship to that is. And that means you have to stay tuned to other things.
Well, my wife runs CamNet, which is a camcorder network, and without a host, you know, without explanations of what you're about to see, what you are seeing, and what you've just seen, and taken by not necessarily professionals, amateurs, artists, activists. And as she has tried to get into the commercial scene without violating her work, they always say, oh, we've been looking for something innovative like this. And then by the time it goes up to the hierarchy, the message is, well, we want an innovative, but not that innovative.
Right. There's what, in other words, what is up at the top of the hierarchy is not a human. It's a max. It's mixed corporate media and its poltergeist rating sensibility. Now, media are an extension of us. They are us, but they are bureaucratized into a situation where you as an individual have a real problem to be allowed to project over a situation that needs that, in that situation, that cliche, a lowest common denominator.
But the people who run the Nielsen ratings,
with poltergeist,
they never took into consideration the mute button. And so with all the money that they pay for commercials, they're being muted. But I guess they depend on the ones who don't mute it, the ones who even watch the commercials when they're watching a VCR.
Well, that gets in. I explained this on my second album, how the Big Brother is the poltergeist, which leads to the ratings. The ratings are total fiction that are projected on us because there is nobody watching advertising anymore. We're free from it, yet it causes inflation. That stuff causes millions of dollars. And so money becomes inflated by the needs of advertising. But the oligarchs, the powers that be, need to provide content, and they need to provide an anti-environment to all the changing programs they have. And the anti-environment, the gold standard, is advertising.
And in the process, since they can take advertising off as a business expense, other taxpayers pay for them to be brainwashed.
That's right.
So it's a very self-fulfilling cycle.
Yeah, so the audience rules, and one cannot think that they are represented in that audience.
All right. We'd like to thank both of you for participating in Contemporary Communication Conference. My name is Jerry Fielka, and thanks to Bob Dobbs, who published the newsletter Perfect Pitch and authored the book.
No, I didn't.
Oh, he authored the book Phatic Communion with Bob Dobbs. and Paul Krasner, who is the publisher of The Realist, and whose current book is entitled Confessions of a Raving Unconfined Nut, Misadventures in the Counterculture. For more information on Contemporary Communication Conference and a list of the books mentioned in this dialogue, please send a self-addressed stamped envelope to 2427½ Glendon, GLYNDON, Venice, California, 90291. Thanks a lot, Paul, and thanks a lot, Bob.
Thanks, Jerry. Thanks, Paul.
Take care. We'll continue sometime.
Okay.
Stay tuned.
So I think, you know, the bottom line is always education.
Right, but I think that the educators in schools are trying to tell kids something that the kids have more experience in and know more about it than the older educator.
Yeah, but if they can just teach them methods to use that consciousness, because they have this awareness and it's kind of unfocused.
Yeah, Adbusters magazine tries to do that.
They do it. Yeah, they do it well. There are, and Adbusters is one of many that are doing it in different ways. So I see it as the early tremors of a wave.
Right. Well, I think that's what the Bob's Media Ecology, the satire on people are looking for, a media ecology, personal and collective. That's the sort of the hidden cause of the 90s. People do. We're past the media hypnotism because of the decentralized media, and so people want to get rid of this pest in their lives in some way.
You know, one of the most poignant things I saw was one of the TV magazine shows was doing a feature on people who were on computer bulletin boards. And this one guy, I would say he was in his 40s, he looked up at the interviewer, smiled, and said, "At last I found my extended family."
Okay, we should close this, Bob, unless you want to call back.
Well, just my final sentence would be, this thing that people are teaching kids about is a lot harder than anybody can express. And so I guess I want people to realize how difficult it is, the situation we're in, to kind of articulate ourselves out of it. That's my Zen proposal.
Yeah, well, I think it's that thing that Jerry quoted before. Let them see that it's fun.
Yeah.
So they don't have any resistance to it.
Even though, you know, the corporations love to have fun as the image of utopia coming to us.
Oh, only because it leads to greater productivity.
Yes.
Well, maybe we can do this again.
Yeah,
you guys could go on forever.
What city are you in?
I'm in New York right now.
You're in China. Don't tell them, Bob.
Wait a minute. Oh, I want to tell you, I have a message from Walter Moore to you.
Oh, yeah?
I was talking to him the other day. He said he'll never forget driving in Mr. Sanders' cab. Does that mean anything to you, or do you have to take too many drugs?
I'll have to search my memory for that one.
Mr. Not Ed Sanders, but an old guy, some kind of cab driver, Mr. Sanders. He said if I said that to you, you'd remember that experience when you drove, I guess, in Mr. Sanders' cab with him.
I have a vague recollection, but obviously things have different impacts on people.
Right. And the other thing was, I don't know if I got exactly right, he said he's still working on something called the karmic wheel.
Oh, yeah.
Is that the traditional meaning, or is that something to...
No, once he was having a real problem, you know, in a suicidal state, and I came to his place, and I had this round...
Is this in the EBO days?
And I had this round thing. It was from a lamp. I wanted to give a gift to my parents, and I wanted to paint something on it. And because I came there and asked him to do this, he took that as a symbol of the karmic wheel and...